This week, I am joined by Dmitry Orlov, who is a Russian engineer and writer whose work is based around collapse, technology, and politics. He is the author of multiple books, including Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, and The Five Stages of Collapse, A Survivor's Toolkit. We will be discussing his book, Shrinking the Technosphere. If you wish to support Emetics Podcast, please find links to our Patreon and merchandise page in the description. Enjoy. Dmitry Orlov, thanks for coming on to the Hermetics podcast.
Great to be with you.
So, as per this podcast, the first question is the Hermetics question, which is if you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation, whom do you pick?
Well, I'm not a big fan of fantasy sports, but I suppose one outstanding question I have is why does everybody believe that democratic institutions are so good when all that ever happens with them is they degenerate into a kleptocracy? And so who would I ask? I suppose the original Democrat in my mind is Genghis Khan. He was the first person who arrived at a democratic structure for the world's largest land empire of all time. So I'd have him along, and then a good practitioner would, I suppose, be Niccolo Machiavelli. And then I'd ask an American along, Thomas Jefferson, and I would ask them that question. Why does everybody feel that democracy is valuable when all that ever happens with democratic institutions is they swiftly degenerate into a kleptocracy, where a tiny minority fleeces the rest?
So if we were to stay on that topic, why do you personally think that people are extremely almost reverent of democracy in general?
Well, it's just, I don't know that they're reverent. It's just that there is this consensus, it would seem. I think it's based on something that Churchill said, that democracy is the worst system except for all the others. And that seems to be a consensus. It's very hard to get anywhere with people by telling them that, well, you know, democratic institutions don't really work, so let's try something else. It's just a non-starter. It's just an observation. It's not something I think, it's something I observe.
So a tiny bit about your biography or your history here, for those that don't know your work. And I think the important aspect is that the two things I see is making your collapse your collapse analysis unique is one that you sort of experienced and written about the experiences of the end of the Soviet Union in relation to collapse, and two, in terms of technology, you're not a Luddite, you're not anti-technology, and you're not harkening back to some form of archaic nostalgia. You wish to wrestle with technology. These are the two things I see as kind of unique to your viewpoint here. Perhaps you could extrapolate just a little about your history, especially in terms of the Soviet Union there.
Well, I was born in Russia. I grew up there. Russia didn't exist at the time. That was the Russian Federative Soviet Socialist Republic. I moved to the United States together with my family as a teenager. Went through school and university in the United States. Worked in the United States. Had several careers. And at the first opportunity, I started going back to what became Russia. Well, first I went back to the Soviet Union in '89, but in subsequent years, it was I was going back to Russia, Russian Federation. And during the 90s, I observed the transformation that took place there. And that got me thinking, how is the United States different? What I saw in the Soviet Union and in Russia was that the system that was entrenched and still functioning was becoming dangerously depleted at every level, starting with being unable to maintain the physical plant and equipment that supported the whole thing, to being unable to replace the elites that ran the system with same caliber human material. I started thinking, well, why has the Soviet Union collapsed, but the United States still hasn't? Part of that answer was that the Soviet Union collapsed first, and that gave the United States a new lease on life, because what happened in the 90s was wholesale looting of everything that wasn't nailed down in the former Soviet Union. All that wealth went west. It was basically just looted. So that was one of the reasons for the postponement. There were several others. But generally, I started looking at the Soviet template and applying it, or trying to apply it, to the United States and the West in general, but mostly to the United States. And it turned out that the Soviet Union was inadvertently much better prepared for collapse than the United States is or ever will be. And that collapse, when it comes in the United States, will be far more destructive than what happened in the Soviet Union or in Russia.
And I believe I'm correct in thinking that, and this is one of the things you make clear in Reinventing Collapse, that the reasons the Soviet Union was better, was far more prepared for collapse, was because the population there already almost had to deal with collapse anyway. Hardly anyone was making ends meet, so they had to find these skills and teach themselves these skills, not as kind of additional extras like they would be currently in the US, but literally because they had to live. So as John Michael Greer, you know, he calls it the long descent, America is within the long descent, but it's just kind of just about holding itself up and not recognizing the problems there. Whereas do you think the people in Russia kind of knew, like, this is coming to an end?
Well, there are differences. Well, first of all, the positives that Russia had with regard to collapse was that it could collapse without hurting the systems very much that kept people alive. So even without a running economy, because it was a command and control economy rather than a market economy, people still had electricity, they still had running water, there was still heat in the houses, public transportation kept running. There was still some kind of food in the stores, although that part of the system collapsed relatively quickly. But there were stockpiles still. Some parts of agriculture kept running, so you could still get staples. There was free medical care, even though access to pharmaceuticals wasn't very good at various times. But people still could get their bones set, and infants were delivered without anybody having to pay for it. And so those were all benefits that the United States does not have. In the United States, if you run out of money, you're pretty much just out on the street digging through garbage. There was some of that happening in Russia, but not as much, at the worst of times, not as much as is happening routinely in the United States today. The homelessness crisis just didn't really hit Russia at all. It's rampant in the US already, even pre-collapse. And then the other huge benefit that Russia had was a very highly educated populace that turned out to be extremely resourceful. Once they realized that they had to start doing things very differently and shifting for themselves, they did start shifting for themselves. It didn't help matters that the government was just incredibly corrupt and surrendered its sovereignty to the United States, mostly the European Union to some extent. But they clawed it back under Putin, and so now you have a good combination of, well-educated people basically managing their own affairs rather well within a market economy this time, without a lot of dependence on outside forces.
Perhaps I'm being a bit stereotypical towards the ideology of Soviet Union here, but do you find there's a little bit of an irony there that against the communist ideology that people had to go, had to become actually very almost individualist? Or was there still a form of community there that was separate from the ideology?
Well, individualism still doesn't get you very far in Russia on a social level. People still do depend on each other here to a great extent. And the traditions of solidarity do appear to hold in a lot of cases. And that's very helpful. As far as the communist ideology, that died sometime during World War II, I think. Anyway, you know, basically, you know, once Lenin was dead and Trotsky was in exile and then dead, you were left with Stalin, and Stalin was not really a communist. I don't know if anybody really appreciates that, but he used capitalist methods to achieve, you know, socialist victories. None of that had to do with communism. And only after Stalin died did some of that came back because of these quote-unquote Ukrainians that went into power, which was Khrushchev and then Brezhnev. And they started talking up, you know, international duty. So the reason the Soviet Union blundered into Afghanistan was to preserve world revolution in some sense. And, you know, that was just the system kind of degenerating. But the public understanding was that the ideology was just this tired old bunch of stuff that people were forced to study and repeat. There was no life to it.
Okay. Do you think that anywhere in the world since Lenin and Trotsky there has been a legitimate kind of communist ideology which people are supportive of as a nation?
Well, Cuba made a try of it, but Cuba is really just socialism with market elements. I mean, that's the only system that works in the world, anywhere in the world, is socialism with market elements.
Is that what you'd consider America then, socialism with market elements?
It's incredibly corrupt socialism with incredibly corrupt market elements, yes. But it's basically, America is unique in that it's generally just eating itself alive. You know, it's a bunch of rackets, as Kunstler likes to put it. And I agree with him. America at this point is just a bunch of rackets.
Okay. I'm sure we'll dip back into a few of those political things there. But just to begin on the kind of collapse and the technology front, and I'm sure you've answered this question quite a few times now, a few of the discussions I've listened to. But if I could just ask you a brief definition of what it is that you entitled the technosphere.
Well, I wrote that book a while ago. It did rather badly commercially for a couple of different reasons. One is that I published it just as Trump got elected. And in the book, I failed to demonize Trump, which made me unpopular with the quote-unquote liberal readership, which was quite a large percentage of it. So a lot of people, you know, bought the book, found out that I was saying positive things about Russia as opposed to claiming that Russia stole the election or some stupid thing like that, and returned it. So it didn't really get very far. And the other thing is that in the book, I expect people to consider changing what they do. Actually, you know, I expected people to do some work, and that's really not a winning move. Expecting people to do something is generally a bad idea. Expecting people to do less is generally a big winner. Any great idea that allows you to just sit there and do nothing is going to be popular. So on those two fronts, it really didn't do well, but I sort of stuck with the subject and explored it some more. And sometime later, I discovered a great Russian thinker by the name of Lev Gumilev, who did a lot of research along these lines. It turns out that the term technosphere was coined early in the 20th century by another great Russian thinker by the name of Vernadsky, a scientist who was the instigator of the Russian, not Soviet, but Russian pre-revolutionary nuclear research program. It was thanks to him that when the Soviet Union became threatened with American nuclear bombs, they could come up with their own nuclear bombs in record time because they already had a program running. They already had stockpiles of material, etc. But anyway, he came up with the term technosphere. And then Gumilev expanded on it and came up with this triad, which is we have the biosphere of the Earth, all of the living things within it. And then we have a sort of emergent entity within the biosphere, which is humanity, but not of the sort of humanity that sleeps on bare ground naked and digs around for tubers with a stick, but humanity that, you know, creates, builds pyramids and creates empires and conquers the world and invents sailing ships and all of this other stuff. And it turns out that there's a process that gives rise to communities of people who are capable of more than just bare survival. He called the process ethnogenesis and had a lot to say on the subject by looking at all of the examples of ethnogenesis from the last 6,000 years or so. And then the technosphere is what ethnogenesis creates. It is the universe of man-made things, which is unlike the biosphere. All it ever does is degenerate. You build it and it falls apart. You build it again and it falls apart. And we're in kind of the late stages of the technosphere now, where it is very highly developed and you can't tell whether it's being built or whether it's falling apart. Competencies are going missing left and right, while new competencies, such as making smartphones even smarter, are zooming ahead for what that's worth. So it's very interesting to look at the world through that prism as that triad and examine the various facets of it.
So what would you say the difference there then? Because you say that the technosphere only degenerates. What would you say the difference with regards to entropy would be between the biosphere and the technosphere?
Well, the biosphere basically is all based on flows, energy flows that are driven by solar energy and some chemical energy, but mostly just solar energy. So it can achieve steady state for long durations, and it's also self-adjusting. So as the climate shifts, certain species do worse, and you know, other species go extinct and something else evolves. And it doesn't really involve a lot of or any human intervention. Whereas the technosphere, if it's not being maintained, it really falls apart. Every last bit of it. You know, even the pyramids are slowly being weathered away, even though they were meant to last forever. But nothing that humans build can last forever. It's all temporary because it's all based on the technosphere.
And you say in your book that this the technosphere is not only a demon, but you specifically allude to it being a demiurge. And I really enjoyed this turn of phrase. Was there a specific reason you called it a demiurge?
I basically tried to appeal to the sensibilities of people who can't think of an emergent system, because that doesn't mean anything to them. So a lot of people are more comfortable thinking in terms of a demonic entity or a spirit than just a mechanism that is so advanced and complicated that it shows it demonstrates some limited ability to reason and actually manifests its own will and can formulate its own agenda. That's a stretch for a lot of people, so I used those terms more as a crutch than anything else.
Okay, so in kind of specific scientific terms, it would be an emergent system.
It's an emergent system.
Okay. Are you sympathetic to the spiritual views, or are you spiritual at all?
Well, yes. I think that that entire realm is, you know, extremely important and completely unrelated to the subject matter.
So the teleology of the technosphere, its end game, it's the point that it's kind of grasping towards in the future. You say this is control. And I think we can say that that's the technosphere's aims unto itself. But can this really be answered to us? Do you think, can we truly say that what the teleology for the technosphere for itself is, or would that just be conjecture?
Well, it's a sort of, imagine it as a robot or an artificial intelligence network. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have taste or touch or human sight. It has certain analytical tools. It can perform certain measurements, right? It can take a photograph and then distill certain elements from it. It can use facial recognition, or it can map lines or contours on a photograph, aerial photograph or satellite photo, and derive from it a map. It has access to a great deal of statistical data, so it can perform various types of analysis. But that is all it can do. It doesn't have any human sensibility. It doesn't have any sort of instinct or any emotional intelligence. And so what it can do is it can control various processes that are within its control. It can, for instance, allow or deny access to credit. That's one of the functions that it is generally absorbing into itself, because it's much better than human analysts. And there are various other functions that it can perform, but all of them are based on this idea of complete control based on incomplete information, because nobody ever has access to complete information. And that is its undoing, I think. It tries to control things more and more tightly, and in the process it destroys whatever it is it tries to control, because it doesn't have access to complete information.
And this is one of the things you really emphasize in the book, that the reason the technosphere and specifically humans kind of almost don't get along, or at least the technosphere doesn't get along with the humans, is because the technosphere adores standardization, and humans in general, at least before being kind of assimilated into the technosphere, are spontaneous and intuitive and free in a certain way, at least when they're children. And so this is one of the things you say that the technosphere does from the off, you know, from day one, really, is find ways to standardize existence.
Well, not all standardization is bad. For instance, if you have standard glass containers for dairy products that you wash yourself and bring to the shops empty, and they're filled by placing them on the scale and measuring out whatever it is you want to buy, then you don't have to deal with recycling a huge number of plastic and paper containers. So that's a victory. On the other hand, if what's being standardized is human brains, children's brains, by forcing them to study for standardized tests, okay? Mm-hmm. That is definitely bad, because who needs standardized brains? We need the opposite of standardized brains. So it's a question of who is in charge. You know, if you have basically an out of control market economy where either you go with the flow or you go broke, and then the technosphere is basically in charge, you defy the technosphere and you go bankrupt. Whereas if the economy is really controlled using an agenda that is based on the production of public goods and on an appreciation of what the common good is, where the profit motive is forced to take a back seat, then the technosphere is not in charge. Humanity is in charge, and humanity makes use of the technosphere. It's a question of who is riding whom, you see. Do we allow the technosphere to ride us, or do we ride it?
And there's hundreds of clear ways now where it's riding us, and I mean ruining our neuroplasticity from day one and molding us into kind of attention drained automatons. But one of the really important things I think that's happening that's being overlooked, especially at least from my personal opinion, in terms of meaning and purpose, is that against standardization, death and especially suffering almost just can't exist. They're not allowed to exist, at least from the technosphere's point of view. These are nonsensical points of contention. And do you think, as a way to kind of almost push back, or as you say, shrink the technosphere, we should begin to form again a more realist understanding of suffering and death?
Well, that is a question of culture. And I think the West, the U.S. and the U.K. and probably a lot of Western Europe has gone very far in the direction of sort of putting everyone in hospice care, even while they're still relatively healthy. Sort of, you know, keep everyone sedated so mm-hmm. they don't struggle, because there's nothing for them to look forward to. So you might as well just hand out drugs and whatever. And make sure that nobody is offended with anything or forced to think, because thought is so painful, you know, unless you think a lot when you're forced to think about something, when especially when you're forced to consider two contradictory notions at the same time. My God, for unpracticed people, that just makes their heads explode. So don't do that. You know, just keep everyone comfortable and sedated until it's all over. That seems to be the approach. But that's not how the rest of the world functions. There are large parts of the world where thinking is just completely verboten. I think there are a lot of places in the world where you're just basically repeating what everyone else says, or you're in trouble automatically. And then there are other places in the world that are renowned for tolerance of just every kind of thinking, where there's no internal censorship whatsoever. And that can be good or bad, but that's what I prefer.
I'm going to ask, which places do you think are, do you see as those places who are that are completely tolerant of any opinion or internal thought?
Russia is definitely one of those places these days. It's extreme in terms of its embrace of freedom of speech. You can get away with anything in Russia except libel and incitement to violence.
Why do you think that is?
Because it would be far more expensive to repress than to simply allow. And the government has enough on its plate that it's just not going to bother.
And would you say that the means that other countries, I mean, I'm thinking specifically of the UK and America here, that the means in which they're suppressing thought is kind of almost twofold? It seems to me that liberal politics definitely plays a part, and also just tech in terms of things like streaming services, binge-watching TV, smartphone addiction. These are kind of secondary causes which are almost weren't intended to do this, but have ended up doing it through their addiction-based design mechanisms. Do you think those two, especially the, I'd like to hear your comments on the liberal politics of the UK and the US and the West in general now, and the way where you see that heading?
Well, I think it's a mess, but I could separate a few pieces out of it. One is, as I mentioned, the idea that of hospice care for the entire society, where everybody has to be sedated and comfortable because they have nothing to look forward to. So their freedom of speech is repressed because you are not allowed to say things that make people uncomfortable, that cause cognitive dissonance and force people to think. Mm-hmm. It's almost illegal to force people to think in the West, it seems. Another is that these governments, the US and the UK especially, and the entire kind of CIA-controlled echo chamber that is Western media, have been lying continuously about a great number of important things. And so the way they make sure that they can continue to lie and that they're not found out as complete and utter liars is to suppress every other kind of message and to label those who disagree with them as the enemy or conspiracy theorists or simply Russians. Yeah, you know, that's becoming increasingly popular. Well, the reason you're saying that is because you're Russian. That seems to be a typical approach these days. So they have to do that. And then, you know, another reason that people in the West have to absolutely keep their mouths shut is because they've been stuck in an explosive situation where if they speak their minds, the result will be utter social chaos. And the problem there is that in the West, people have been increasingly herded together with people from incompatible cultures, incompatible on an organic level. It's not that they don't want to get along. It's not that they've been brought up wrong, so they can't get along. It's that they never will. They're like different animals of different species that don't mix. And that is not a message that can be allowed to get out, because the result will be social explosion. So anyone who voices the idea that certain people are not compatible with certain other people in the world, which is a very obvious point, you know, is met with a great deal of derision, and anybody who espouses those ideas runs the risk of being labeled as, you know, whatever people like to call as, you know, calling names fascist or racist or whatever else, right-wing, populist. You know, there's a long list of derogatory terms that is deployed.
And this ties in with actually your latest book, which I read, and I was quite taken aback by everything is going according to plan, and so. Just to spring off the title there, and this is something you do explain in the book, there's this, you see that there's an underlying, can I say, agenda to all of this. Would that be correct?
Yes, it is an unmistakable sort of drift to what's happening. I don't know that any human thinking intelligently as a free agent set that agenda or had anything to do with it. It's just it seems like more of a trap that everybody is automatically falling into.
If I was to be extremely speculative, could we say that the trap we've fallen into is almost being set by almost like a pseudo-conscious technosphere?
Yes, we could say that. I don't know. Well, consciousness is difficult to, you know, difficult to measure. How conscious someone is, but you can definitely see will within it. It's clear what it wants to do. So as people are replaced with robots, we need fewer people. To have fewer people, we have to convince people that the planet is overpopulated and they shouldn't have children. You know, that's logical, because mm-hmm. we have robots. We don't need people, and there are a lot of thought processes like that sort of short circuits any moral argument you might have in favor of a much more simple argument that is purely organizational, purely technical.
Just to stay on the technosphere here as well, I don't know if you're familiar with accelerationist thought, but as one of your kind of primary focuses is political, I would like to see what you make of it. So the idea that the only way out of this is through, that we should accelerate the process of techno-economic expansion. And just to quickly overview the three major currents. So left-wing accelerationism is to go towards automation and emancipation of man via technology. Right-wing is towards a singularity. And unconditional is just to let it do what it's doing and just see what happens. But each one of them wishes to accelerate it for its own aims. Would you think this callous, or do you think there's something in this, especially against kind of older methods of reversion or revolution?
Well, what disgusts me about both of them is that they use the word "we" gratuitously, and they tend to use the word "must" as well. So who the hell are they to tell everyone what to do? That's my first question.
That may be me just explaining it in a kind of relaxed overview.
They always say things like "we must." We meaning everyone, all humans on the planet, and "must" in terms of them telling everyone what to do. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, intimating that their idea is very important and we should listen to it. And my approach is there is no "we," there's "you," whoever you are, which is different from who I am, and your opinion is not really important to me necessarily. You're just in some institution somewhere talking to people like you. Leave the rest of the planet alone. And my feeling is that there are a lot of different civilizations or lack of civilization on this planet, and they will go their separate ways. And one of the biggest problems with the world is that they're all being herded in the same direction right now, and that is just not going to work at all. But in terms of where different countries are going, there is a gradual breakdown having to do with the quality of energy that's ongoing, and it's been happening for a while now. It's really a technical issue. The energy returned on energy invested in the energy that sources that drive the entire economy has been falling continuously. Whatever replacements people are coming up with are worse. So, you know, corn ethanol is just absolutely horrible. Windmills and solar panels are a little bit better, but still bad. Mm-hmm. Everything else is just so slowly dwindling, except maybe for natural gas in certain areas. And because of that, a lot of economies are shrinking. So the Italian economy, as an example, has I think, gone down 25% so far this century. There's overall economic shrinkage as the energy industry eats up more than its previous share. Eventually, it'll just eat up all that's left. So that's happening. So that'll result in some countries being energy rich and some countries being energy poor. And you can definitely see those shifts happening today. You know, people are not really adjusting to the situation. They think in sort of 20th century terms, even though we're pretty far into the 21st century. So they still think, for example, in the West, they still think that Russia absolutely must export oil and natural gas, because what else could they possibly export? And it turns out that Russia doesn't really need energy exports anymore to maintain a positive trade balance with the rest of the world. Isn't that a shock? They don't have to sell you oil and natural gas. They only do it because they like you, you know? Sort of. Question is why. But there are shifts like that happening that are breaking the planet into clusters, technology clusters or lack of technology clusters. The U.S. is quickly becoming a lack of technology cluster. You know, it's becoming incredibly challenged in all sorts of areas. It can't rearm itself without the help from China. You know, China is the only place where they can buy the machine tools so that they can make rockets to point back at China. There are lots of examples like that. But I don't think that any sort of techno-triumphalist stands a chance, because they have to think of what part of the world they're going to appeal to, because there's no one world anymore. There won't be. It's over.
This kind of slides in, not being one world, so that's pushing us into, as you say, these separate areas of technology and in different areas of the world. But a big question is within that, especially within the future, and it's a big question in a lot of your work, is freedom. And of course, as we've mentioned with the technosphere, freedom is already completely obscured under layers and layers of technological crap. You know, a good example that you give is the classic kind of the freedom to own your car, but everyone says it's so freeing, but really no one thinks about the freedom. Is really the freedom to pay upkeep, commute to work, potentially get in a car crash, etc., etc. The downsides to technology are never brought to the fore, ever. It's always new technology is good, more technology is good, old technology is bad, etc., etc. So from this kind of new freedom that we've got, where your freedom is basically based around latching yourself to the latest in quotation marks, innovation, where can we still find, dare I say, an authentic freedom? Is that possible?
It is possible. It is very difficult. It's a challenge that I've tackled in my own life. You see, I'm an engineer by training. I've had several careers in high tech. And at some point, I decided to open up with these ideas that I've had for a long time, for over a decade, and start writing. And so I started a blog, and I started writing books. And then I found out that my career prospects in terms of engineering were becoming complicated by the fact that people wouldn't hire me based on my writing things that they didn't necessarily think would be agreeable to their various corporate stakeholders, that I would not be a sort of person that they would want around, mm-hmm. because I might make people think about things other than next quarter's profitability. And that's bad. Okay, so for a while there, you know, I had to find new ways to sort of get around those limitations. And I did find ways, but the moment you start trying to jump out of the mainstream and exercise your freedom, as it were, become free, not just repeat whatever is saying and, you know, nod agreeably when you listen to absolute nonsense, as you have to, the moment you do that, you marginalize yourself socially. Not a lot of people are able to deal with the stress, and not a lot of families can put up with members who go through that process. And not everybody can emerge on the other end with a new living arrangement, new set of patterns to live by that is agreeable to them and that makes them happy. So those are the limitations of freedom. Either you stay locked in the cabinet or you escape. But once you escape, then nobody is going to be replenishing the cookie jar in the cabinet for you automatically.
So in what ways do you feel you found freedom? Because I understand you live on a boat.
Well, I made a number of changes. One is I made a number of changes. First was I just quit the corporate work altogether. I did various gigs, but that's kind of different than having a position. So that's kind of a step down. And then I got rid of that too. Then I decided that the hugest drain on people in the UK and in the United States and in much of the West is paying rent. People spend absolutely exorbitant amounts of money, most of their income, just on rent. And so I cut that out by buying a boat and moving aboard with my wife. Then I found out that we liked sailing and wanted to go sailing, but sailing is incompatible with any kind of a work schedule at all. Because the wind doesn't keep to a schedule. And so you want to go sailing when the wind is good and work on, calm, rainy days. And so I adjusted to that and went sailing. And then we found out that spending winters up north is a bad idea. So we started spending winters in the tropics. And then later on, I discovered that with all of the ability these days to do stuff via the internet, just about everything can be done via the internet. Nobody has to show up anywhere anymore in person. That there's no reason to stay in the West at all. So now we don't really spend a lot of time anywhere in the West at all. It's just we're just leaving that whole thing behind. We still have various relationships, personal, work-related, et cetera, that tie us to the United States, et cetera. But we don't have to spend much time there at all.
And do you think that people, because everyone goes on about wanting to be free, wanting to escape is the classic one. Do you think people truly believe this or are people apathetic or are they ignorant or even knowingly ignorant of their, of the trap they've been caught in?
Well, I think a lot of people just aren't really capable of making any dramatic changes in their lives because all their lives have been directed towards forming habits. Some habits are good, like, doing your homework. Some habits are bad, like, going out drinking beer. But they're all habits. So if you're a creature of habit, you can't really do anything radical with your life. Some people are, their entire character is some combination of their various vices. If you rid them of their vices, what would be left? Just some very boring entity.
So if we just dip back into the technology discussion, as I said before, your unique position is that you want to wrestle with technology and you want to draw it back to a point of almost the point where each and every bit of technology has a purpose. And we kind of go through it almost, perhaps this is the wrong word, but in a conservative manner. Where do you draw the line between gratuitous tech, which is, just a shiny trinket, and legitimate innovation? Because we always hear that word innovation and people hold up iPhones to kind of try make some point about us progressing. But where is the line where you go, this is legitimately needed and useful?
Well, I think that there's a standard to go by. See, there's this postmodernist take on reality, which is everything is a narrative and an opinion, and everything is virtualized. Everything is just a message. Everything is based on appearance. And so all of the innovations that we've had so far, the virtualization of various things, electronic this and network that, and all of those sorts of things basically aren't real on a fundamental level. They exist until the battery dies. After that, they don't exist anymore. It's amazing what happens in a blackout. Not just various devices run out of juice and wink out, or the network goes down, but people's brains go down. People lose their minds. It's gotten to that point. So that's how you tell that you've gone in the wrong direction with the technosphere. If the power goes out and people lose their minds and society falls apart, okay, well, that all of that is not worth preserving. Whereas if the power goes out and you just means you go out back and start the generator and everything's back in order, you know, that's kind of a stopgap because there you are until the gasoline or the diesel runs out. You can improve on that quite a bit by being relatively independent of that sort of tightly organized system, making it more autonomous. So power goes out, well, you still have wood. You still have a wood stove. There are still potatoes growing out back, and life goes on. You have books to read. Life can be a lot simpler. But in addition to that simple life, you can have major advancements. You can have good medical care. You can have good education. You can have all the trimmings without the dependence. And I think that's what people should strive for.
That we can have the option to pick and choose. You don't have to have everything that since, I don't know, I think Greer says from the 70s onwards is really the time period that we're dealing with when we start talking about collapse and the long emergency. That's the Reagan era onwards seems to be the point where it really pushed into high gear. You can have parts of that, but you don't have to have all the excess that came with it. So this era, which I don't know if you'd agree, kind of started in the 70s and will probably start to peter out, let's say 2040, 2050, or at least we'll start seeing very, very clear signs, clearer than the ones we're getting now, which is still pretty clear for those that are looking. What do you think, and obviously this is quite vague, but the next 10 to 30 years will look like for us?
I think it'll be different in different places. So if you look at, I don't know, San Francisco, mm-hmm. Which is full of kind of drugged out zombies, well, they'll probably be even more drugged out zombies, right? That's the trend. And if you look at, Shanghai, well, they're putting up high-rise buildings and becoming ever more prosperous and rich. So I guess that's going to continue to be the trend. And if you look at the Congo, well, that's going to probably have more Ebola outbreaks and various plagues, et cetera. And that will be the trend there. So you will have to look at each place in the world and not in general terms, but in case you want to go there, you will have to evaluate it based on what it is and based on what it is to you. Because people have limited options in terms of where they can fit in and blend in and become compatible.
You briefly mentioned rent earlier, and I think we'll kind of finish on this, just this final little discussion here about your, this is your, I believe, an ongoing project, and it's your kind of current project, Quidnon, which is mm-hmm. A kind of a houseboat.
We've had... it's basically a kit boat that I've been working on for a number of years with several other people. And at various points, people got excited about it, but there have been some delays. And now it's at a point where I think we actually can see when we're going to produce a set of plans that we can build a full-scale boat from. Mm-hmm. So far, we've been only working with models. But basically, it's an extremely durable, low maintenance, cheap place to live autonomously. Could be at a marina in the center of town, or it could be in a completely wild place. It can handle the ocean. It can handle rivers and canals. It's roomy enough so that a family can live aboard. And now that young people in various cities in the U.S. are paying upwards of $1,000 a month for a bunk bed, mm-hmm. you know, it actually will offer a very good alternative for a lot of people so that they can save up money and escape instead of squandering it all on rent.
You say that it'll allow people to be autonomous. I mean, how far will it allow that? Will it allow certain elements of self-sufficiency as well?
Well, yes, because we've thought very hard about how to heat it, how to cool it, how to supply it with drinking water, how to make it move using the wind so that it's not entirely dependent on gasoline, how it could generate electricity by itself. Various aspects like that have been taken care of. So it can actually be a pad in the center of town at a marina where you just sleep and save money on rent. Or it could be a sort of summer production platform where you go up a river somewhere and grow food or gather food or fish or hunt and preserve all of that food and bring it back with you. You know, there are a lot of options in terms of what the use one can put this vessel to. It can even be used as a floating clinic so that medical and dental services can be delivered to remote areas. There's just no limit to what people could do with it. And it's all basically, it's a kit. Some parts are plasma cut and welded using expensive and advanced techniques. And much of the rest of it is basically just something that any amateur builder can handle. In fact, somebody who can assemble IKEA furniture is pretty far along in terms of being able to build this boat.
Do you see the sea as rivers in general as an entirely underutilized source of both living and existence, really?
Well, I think what we're seeing is almost a doubling of the amount of precipitation in a lot of places. We see record flooding in a great number of areas. Ocean levels are predicted to rise, not everywhere on the planet, because also the ocean currents are becoming reconfigured. But in a lot of places where people live along the coasts, they're going to be swamped. And so living aboard a boat that can float up when there's a flood and settle down again when the waters recede is an incredible life hack. It's just so much better than living in a house that's just going to flood and become ruined. And then what do you do? Build a new house? Well, you're going to run out of money pretty quickly doing that. So living aboard a boat that is on land, but on land that is no longer quite habitable in the usual way, is an option that will be available and will be the only option available to a great number of people in the coming decades. In fact, you know, that will be their only choice. So when the waters recede, they'll get around by bicycle. And when there's a flood, they'll get around by boat, paddle around. And that's the way people will live. They will have an autonomous source of drinking water from gathering rainwater. There'll be lots of driftwood they could burn for heat and for cooking. And this boat design takes all of that into account.
Okay. So when do you think Quidnon will be ready?
I don't know. I will do what I can as quickly as I can. And we're probably looking at a couple of years before we have some number of Quidnons floating around in various parts of the world. But I've had people express serious interest in this design from many parts of the world, many parts of the U.S., U.K., New Zealand, Australia, Poland, Holland, Russia. Hmm. And so I think it's going to be an interesting project.
Okay. Final question here, as I've asked both John Michael Greer and James Kunstler this, two other collapse experts, so to speak. What advice would you have for specifically younger generations who are maybe a bit more clued up, things they can be doing heading into the future to be a little bit more prepared?
It's all about skills, and not skills that have to do with sitting in front of a computer, but skills in terms of dealing with people and things you can do with your hands using tools you own. So that's what they should concentrate on.
And this is anything you'd like to add or talk about that we've missed, then I think it's a good place to finish.
Well, my book, The Five Stages of Collapse, is finally coming out in Swedish. Okay. I'm happy to announce. It's been many, many years. Politics in Sweden has advanced to the point where my work is now acceptable to the general reading public there. So that gives me great joy.
Any Swedish listeners, Olof's Five Stages of Collapse is now available, yeah?
It's not yet, but it will be soon.
Oh, okay, we'll be soon.
From Carnival.
Okay, yes. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you.